I'm Jocelyn Connors, and I'm chairman of the Faith and Justice Committee. And we're so glad to have you here. This is the second in our series of this issue that we're facing in our community. And the purpose of our committee is to educate all of us. And I'm so thrilled to see so many people who are concerned about these issues and who are attending our monthly luncheons. And thank you very much for coming. We have several of our committee members. We're all wearing little tags. And afterwards, when everything's finished, if people would like to stay for a while and talk about what we do today, we'd be more than happy to meet with you. So stick around if you're able to. So thank you very much, and I'm going to introduce you to our rector, Dixon Kinzer.
Hi. So the Faith and Justice Committee has been putting on these lunches, and exactly as Jocelyn explained, for the purposes of learning, but also for the purposes of being some sort of Christian response to the issues of injustice and the challenges that we face as people in our case, Winston-Salem these days. This conversation about race has been on the forefront of things, and what we decided when the committee was talking that we would do as a uniquely Christian response is that we would preference the act of listening first in our response. As you know, many of the most difficult conversations that we try to have in our culture get sidetracked when folks wait to talk and they don't listen, or they are in some way aggressive in response, and there's not the ability to have a give and take get shut down. And so we really looked at the difference between debate, which is how most conversations in the public sphere take place, whether it's by paid TV personalities, politicians, even civic leaders. Who's going to win an argument, us versus them, might makes right, and how that wasn't particularly a Christian way to approach these kinds of conversations. And so we thought, well, what is? And the theme of testimony came up. Testimony versus debate. Testimony is about telling your story. It's about disclosing truth because of what's happened to you. And so for at least the first semester of these conversations, we are listening to the testimony of people that have been in the midst of it. Last month, we had Mark and John. This month, we have Joyce and Barry to tell their stories and to help us understand from their perspective what it's like. Now, you may know, Joyce, of course, is one of our parishioners, and you know her because she's in the choir, she's doing Eucharist, or you see her around. Barry, you may also recognize, he happens to have a prominent job in the community. What was it you did? Oh, right, the chief of police. And it was really important to us, though, because, we were chatting earlier, Barry does a lot of things like this, where at the end of a session, or even at the beginning, questions are coming at him, and it's you don't often get to sort of share how you feel about things. You have to justify things. You have to answer things. And so it's not really your story. It's people wanting you to defend something or answer a question that may even be unanswerable. And so we thought, well, if the chief of police is going to be here and we're going to have a Christian thing going on, we're going to take a different tack on that. And so we're really interested, Barry, in your story, your approach, where you're coming from. And we're really glad that you're here because of that. Joyce, same for you. We're really glad that you're here to share your approach, your story, your experiences. And as has been the practice started last month, we won't have a time of Q&A afterward. We're just going to listen. We're not going to respond to the speakers directly. We are going to pass out some slips of paper to fill out questions that come up for you, things that you can get feedback to the committee through. Especially if you have to leave, please do write some questions. That was extremely helpful after the last meeting. But if you can, you want to stick around, as Jocelyn said, please do. You can gather in little clumps around the tables, and committee members might even join you just to hear what you're saying, how you're processing. I will say, lastly, before we start, that there is, in January, an event that I'm going to talk about at the end that will give us a chance to start dialoguing. And to begin that process after we've practiced listening. But for today, let us train and rehearse in the art of holy listening. And welcome Corey, who's going to introduce our testifiers. So thank you all. Corey, thank you.
Thank you, we're just using this one.
All right. Well, good afternoon. I'm Corey Miller, and I'm really pleased to be here. And so what I want to do, because you're not having a chance to speak with Joyce or the chief directly, I want to share their bios a little bit with a little bit more detail. So here it is. So this is, I'm talking about Joyce Moi. So Joyce is originally from San Mateo, California, and she lived there until she graduated from St. Matthew's Episcopal Day School. She then relocated to Birmingham, Alabama, and graduated from high school. She received a BS from Alabama A&M University with a major in marketing and minored in forestry. And she met who would eventually become her husband, John Paul, at A&M. He was one of the foreign students there. He is originally from Cameroon, West Africa. He is over there. And his intent was to study and receive his doctorate and then return home to Cameroon. Well, Joyce may have had a little bit to do with him staying around. So her minor in forestry happened when the U.S. Forest Service came to her university to recruit minority students to work for this agency, where she was selected. And her original placement was in Missoula, Montana, beautiful place, where she spent two full summers working there. And after she married John Paul, though, she wanted to relocate to Lincoln, Nebraska. He was in a PhD program there, and she wanted to be with him. So then she was able to relocate to Lincoln. And while in Nebraska, she worked for the Natural Resource Conservation Service, their regional office, which covered five states, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, and Colorado. And they lived there for 5 years, and that is where their son, Lewis Patrick, was born. And after John Paul completed his doctorate, he was offered a position with Brown and Williamson Tobacco in Macon, Georgia, and that's where their daughter, Azoma, was born. And they relocated there and then found out 5 years later that they needed to relocate yet again, this time in our community here in town. And that's, a lot of you may know Brown and Williamson folks who transferred in around 2004. They were part of that group. And they have been living in Advance for 11 years now. Joyce is the mother of three, Anthony and Lewis Patrick and Azoma. And she has several siblings, three younger sisters, and one older brother who actually is in law enforcement, retired from law enforcement in Maryland, and he is now in Florida and doing work as a police officer there. And so while in North Carolina, she has worked for Weight Watchers for 9 years and currently works at the YMCA as a group exercise fitness instructor. You may have seen her there. And she's also a personal trainer, but she says, "You'll find me on the floor encouraging groups of people to move. I felt that I could reach more people in my current role encouraging fitness and healthy lifestyle changes." And that's a wonderful thing. They have been members of St. Paul's for 10 and a half years, and she was asked, Jocelyn Astley asked her a couple days ago if she was a cradle Episcopalian. Her answer was yes and no. The Episcopal Church is all she's ever known, and in California, she attended St. Matthew's Episcopal Day School. And she wanted to join the choir in first grade, but you aren't allowed to join the choir until you're in third grade. However, she got special dispensation, in her case, that if her family joined the church, she could join the choir. They did, and she has sung in a choir until her children have become choristers themselves. And I will say, I serve as a chalice bearer in worship with Joyce, and it's her voice probably what gave her the true special dispensation. She has a beautiful voice, and it makes me feel good because I can blend in and get drowned out very easily. So that's Joyce Moi. Let's give her a hand and welcome her. Okay, next will be Chief Roundtree, and he was appointed police chief for the city of Winston-Salem on July 1st, 2013. Time flies. The police department has, I didn't realize this, 560 sworn police officers and 163 non-sworn employees. Chief Roundtree started his career with the Winston-Salem PD as a police officer in 1988. He was promoted to senior police officer in 1992, sergeant in 1996, lieutenant in 2000, captain in 2004, and assistant police chief in 2007. He has served in the Field Services Bureau, Investigative Services Bureau, Support Services Bureau, and the Professional Standards Division. He's really worked his way up for sure. Chief Roundtree was awarded the Advanced Law Enforcement Certificate in August of 1994 by the North Carolina Criminal Justice Education and Standards Training Commission. He is a North Carolina State Certified Basic Law Enforcement Training General Instructor. That's a mouthful. He is a graduate of the 31st session of the Administrative Officers Management Program at NC State University and completed the Municipal Administration Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He also holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Business Administration from here in town, from Winston-Salem State University, and a Master's in Public Affairs from UNCG. He's a member of several professional organizations, to include the International Associations of Chief of Police, North Carolina, North State Law Enforcement Officers Association, North Carolina Police Executives Association, and he is the regional director for the North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police. Chief Roundtree is a life member of Omega Psi Phi fraternity and Winston-Salem State University National Alumni Association. He is married to Sylvia Roundtree, and they have one son, Barry Jr. They are members of Galilee Missionary Baptist Church here in Winston-Salem. All right, let's welcome Chief Roundtree. All right, the goal is not for me to talk the whole time, so I am going to try to exit as quickly as possible. But I do have some questions, and that's what I'll do to kind of continue or spark the conversation here. So Chief Roundtree, let's start with you. Why did you agree to be here today?
I've been asking myself that. No. No, I think it's important for the police department to, myself and members of the police department, to be involved in these type of community conversations. So that's why I agreed to do it. You know, that's a lot of negative spotlight, negative publicity on law enforcement. So that's why it's important a lot of times for us to come and we can get our story out also.
Okay. Well, let's go back a little bit for you. What originally inspired you to enter into law enforcement?
Well, I always liked law enforcement. Now, my parents didn't want me to be a police officer. You know, I'm from Eastern North Carolina, Wilson, North Carolina. They told me, we sent you up here to go to college and get a degree, and you have a degree in business, and now you want to be a police officer. So they really didn't want me to be a police officer. But I was always fascinated with law enforcement. My mom said when I was a young boy, I always used to go up to the police officers in the city where I grew up, and you know, I would always walk up to them and shake their hand. They would always talk to me. So I guess that's where it started from. And then as I got into law enforcement, I really saw how I could change some things and also shape the lives of individuals. And so that's why I'm still here today.
Thank you. What makes you the most proud about the work of the Winston-Salem PD?
Well, I think we've done a lot of good since I've been at the police department. You know, there are always going to be some negatives. You know, of course, some of the things that you see now in the media, you know, the media has a very powerful way of shaping public opinion. So some of the things that you see on TV about the Winston-Salem Police Department and about law enforcement nationally, there's always two or three sides to every story. They're not saying that what you've seen recently is all wrong or it's not all right either, but a lot of times there's more to the story than what you see locally written in the newspaper or what you see on TV.
And so what are some of the ways that you see the police department saving lives?
Well, we do it every day just from the calls for service. We respond to over 250,000 calls a year to the citizens of Winston-Salem. Now, you're not going to see some of the positive stuff that we do in the community because it's not going to be shown on TV. You know, they refuse to show it, even though they have the information. But if there's something negative, you know, I don't know if anyone in here is associated with the media, but if there's something negative, they beat our door down trying to get information. But the positive stories, whether it's saving a life, whether it's mentoring students in school, whether it's feeding the homeless, or whatever it may be, a lot of those stories you aren't going to see.
All right, Joyce, let me ask you. So I'll ask you the same opening question. Why did you say yes to be here today?
Because you asked me to
begin with. Very nice.
But when you asked, I thought about this, and I thought about it again today. And in just the past couple of months, everything happening from South Carolina, Maryland, Florida, St. Louis, for me, it was fear. I remember clenching my fists and thinking, I'm so afraid because I'm looking at my husband, there's my son, and I feel like my community is under attack. And then I remember saying, I'm not going to walk forward in fear. I am not going to walk forward in fear. But then the question was, do I belong here? Because no one in my church was addressing this, and I kept waiting for a sermon or for somebody to say something, and I got silence. So the answer was stay put, wait. And the fact that I see this happening tells me I need to be here addressing this. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's powerful. So how did you kind of alluded to it, but how does this environment, the current climate of things between law enforcement and the African American community, how does it affect your family?
My son is afraid of police officers, and I have my brother who is a police officer and my uncle who's an FBI agent. I have trainers that I work with who are police officers. So he sees them. He sees them in a positive light, yet he's afraid. He came to me in tears and said, "When is it my turn?" And I remember having to hold him and saying, "This doesn't apply to you." But he's convinced that he's going to die in police custody and not be able to say goodbye to his family. I hope I've gotten him past that fear, that particular fear. He wanted to be here today, and I said, "No, because I'd have to pull you out of school, then you'll get upset, and then I'd pull you back in school, and I can't do that." However, I met the police chief. He's a cool guy. He's offered to talk to you, and he's open to that. And I think having someone that's a police officer that he doesn't know in full uniform talk to him one-on-one will help him push past that fear. So.
That's great. Yeah. Now you, how about in your life? How do you believe, how have you been treated differently by law enforcement in your feeling because you're African American?
My story probably would start in Nebraska, and let me give you a little background. John Paul graduated a year before I did and relocated to Nebraska. That left me behind to finish my degree, plan a wedding to get to him. 6 months prior to all of that, a young lady was brutally raped and murdered at the University of Nebraska. The police department there talked to a few guys. Some white males said, well, the young lady was talking to some black males. So they pulled a few of the black males out of college, out of the classes, to interrogate them. Then they wanted to take it a step further, and they asked the University of Lincoln, Nebraska, for a roster of all the black males that attended that university so that they could interrogate them all. I am more fortunate that the university said no, because John Paul would have been caught up in that sweep. So I'm coming into this situation where it's hostile. There are no riots, but people are very upset with valid reasons. And then I'm hearing through John Paul, well, that's not the only thing. It's just the biggest one that's happening. So that's where my eyes were open. I remember any time I drove anywhere longer than a block from my house, I was going to be tailed. And my license tags were going to be checked. It was just a fact of life. Rule number one, don't speed. Rule number two, keep your tags in check. Rule number three, keep a low profile so that I would be left alone. If I lingered, somebody is going to call a code in a department store because it's going to be assumed that I'm stealing. Sure enough, here they come. So I learned not to linger. I walk in, I walk out. Do you remember Thanksgiving? A group of families are having a Thanksgiving dinner at a friend's house. We're saying our goodbyes. Policeman comes screeching up. And so we're looking at him like, why are you here? One of the neighbors said that there is a disturbance. The disturbance was us walking 5 feet from the door to our car as we're saying goodbye. He didn't know what to do with us. So we look at him, it's like, well, nothing's going on. We're just saying goodbye. Then he became agitated. And as he became agitated, the host of the house became agitated. So we're trying to tell her, just calm down. We're going anyway. Don't provoke anything. Yeah. That was Nebraska. Because of that, I am more wary of just being in a crowd, more wary of police. I did notice in Georgia, and again here, that if I linger, I will have a code. So the department stores I will go into, and I go straight to what I need, and I get out. Some I just don't go into because it's just not worth the trouble of looking at a police officer and saying, I'm not going to steal anything. Nothing you have is worth it. I live in Davie County. Coming home August from the gym, where I spend a lot of my time, as I'm exiting onto 801, across there's a police officer coming by. We lock eyes, and he immediately made a U-turn. Tailed me from the freeway to my neighborhood. He's reading my tags, not a big deal. But I wasn't speeding. In fact, I was doing nothing but going home. So as I'm driving, I'm thinking, what's your plan B? Because I don't feel very safe. I mean, I don't want to call 911. If he sees me call anyone, texting, calling while driving, that's a strike right there. Two, if I call, what am I going to say? He's going to be the one that answers the call. Plan B, always have plan B. So I'm watching him in my rearview mirror. He's watching me. And my thought was, I'm going to go into my neighborhood and see what he does. I sure as heck am not going home. Plan B was to make a U-turn and go to the Mocksville Police Department and see if he follows me there. As I pull in, he rubbernecks, drives by very slowly, and then he progresses on. So did that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Okay.
What is your take? And obviously this is, I mean, there's certain parts that are, that's not new, but what is your feel about the tension, the level of tension in the last 18 months? I mean, do you feel like it's different? And if you do, then to what degree?
I feel that it's elevated considerably. And a lot of it has to do with what Chief Roundtree said. There's the media portrayal, because you see nothing but bad in the media. Again, I have a police officer in the family, so as I'm talking to him, you know, talk me through this, there's more to the story. There, you know, there's things that we don't hear, but then when I'm seeing what I see, it makes me question, it just makes me question.
Chief, what has the Winston-Salem Police Department done in response to...
I thought you were going to ask me the question you asked her.
Yeah.
No, I'll add, because I'm not always in uniform. Of course, today I'm not. But doing my youth in Wilson and even here, I've never been stopped for a reason that I didn't deserve. Now, I've been stopped before. But either I was speeding or either I was rolling through a stop sign or there was some reason why I was stopped, me personally. Now, like she mentioned, in a store, that's something different. And that's not because they're police officers. You know, that's everyday citizens like you that may be working in the store that think that I'm up to something because I'm a black male. But that's not a police officer. So I have experienced that. But I cannot honestly sit here and say that I've been stopped just because I'm black. I haven't. And I've been given citations before I was a police officer. But I was guilty. I was speeding when I was stopped. But just stopped for no reason, no. I've never been stopped for no reason. And that's even now in my personal car. Even if I'm in Winston-Salem or Durham or Charlotte or wherever it may be.
Okay. So in light of the tensions that have been increased, what is the Winston-Salem PD doing to respond to that, or how do you think the best way is to respond to that?
Well, we're aware of it, but we're not responsible for some of the things that you see on TV.
Well, of course.
We have done a few things just for awareness. Of course, we have our regular state-mandated training, but I've also instituted some additional diversity training that all the members of the police department has gone through this year. And in addition to that, you know, I'm sure you've seen the reports about legislation or requiring law enforcement to have body cameras. Yeah, that's not the answer. You know, it's all about behavior. You know, if you're going to be a crooked police officer without a camera, you're going to be one, or if you have a camera. Well, we do have body-worn cameras. That's something that I initiated in early 2013. Actually, my predecessor, we actually started a pilot program. This thing has a bad echo. A pilot program for body-worn cameras, just so we can be transparent here in the city. Starting early July of 13, when I was appointed, I started the process of gradually getting body-worn cameras. And that was pre-Ferguson. Ferguson, Missouri incident with Michael Brown that occurred in August of 2014. So we were actually ahead of the curve here in Winston-Salem as far as getting body cameras. And now we're outfitted, our entire patrol fleet is outfitted with body-worn cameras. So there's a lot of different views, a lot of different perspectives about what's going on, but I don't think that we're seeing some of the issues here in Winston-Salem like you've seen across the country.
Right. So it might be helpful to understand a little more, and you mentioned it kind of in passing in our earlier conversation. How does the statutory role of an officer come into play in certain situations?
Well, of course, the law, North Carolina law, gives an officer the authority to do certain things that a regular citizen can't do. You know, of course, we can conduct traffic stops. We can require the person, by law, you are required to surrender your license. Some of the things that have occurred from based on what I've seen is may not necessarily always be because the person is being resistant, but by law, the officer does have the authority to require certain documents from individuals. We can actually detain individuals, and if necessary, we can use certain level of force to effect an arrest in certain situations. But that authority, by the same token, can't be abused. You know, you have to use it when it's proper and when it's lawful.
And it might be helpful to understand a little more, too, about escalation, and it probably can't just put it with a broad brush, but how is provocation dealt with before escalating to an officer using a firearm or you know, withdrawing their firearm or a taser and that kind of thing?
Well, depending on what level of force you're talking about, there's several different levels of force. You know, you as a citizen has a certain ability to use force if you're threatened. The same thing with a police officer. You know, just because somebody yell at you doesn't necessarily, well, just because a person may yell at you or push you, that's not deadly force. We can use deadly force in situations where we can protect ourselves, or we can use deadly force to protect a third party, which may be you. Someone may be using a deadly weapon on you, and a deadly weapon doesn't necessarily have to be a firearm. You know, you can use a bat. You can use this table as a deadly weapon. So the law authorizes a police officer to use deadly force in certain situations. Now, of course, we use what we call a use of force continuum. That's where we start escalating our level of force depending on the actions and the level of force that the person that we're dealing with are displaying. So that's how a police officer escalates the level of force. Whether our physical presence, the uniform, the badge, that's the first level of force, you know, just showing up. Then it may be soft hand techniques. And then, of course, we can gradually escalate to the other tools that we have, whether it be pepper spray, a taser, a baton, and then lastly is the firearm.
Okay. Do you think society loses when police are disciplined or prosecuted?
Not necessarily. It depends on what that person has done. You know, if the police officer has done something that's illegal or clearly against the law, society wins. But if it's just a tit for a tat where Officer Roundtree did this, so we're going to prosecute him just to set an example for everybody else, yes, society loses at that point. But if the officer has done something, stolen something, or shot someone illegally, yes, that person should be prosecuted.
Joyce, you've mentioned some of these, but what are the rules? You mentioned sort of the rules that you live by as an African-American woman. Do you want to elaborate a little more on that?
And I'll talk to you about kind of the rules I've given my son. We'll start from there. Two strikes, you're African-American, you're male. So you're going to be perceived as a threat to some people. Is that fair? No. Is life fair? No. So what do you do? One, be yourself. Two, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. Three, be the best you can be. Now, what does that mean? Because he's heard people tell him, you'll amount to nothing. Why are you in this honors class? You don't belong here. You're a dumb butt. You're not even going to college. Four, don't get angry. Get even. How? By smiling and making straight A's to prove them wrong. He's doing that. My rules is pretty much keep a low profile, hands in view when I'm shopping, so you know that I'm not trying to do the sticky finger, the five-finger discount thing. We both have tempers. He gets it from me. I admit it. But I'm one that if you push and push and push and push, I can't guarantee what's going to happen when I snap. And I've had to teach him, yeah, don't do that. That's not a good thing. Swallow it. Come home, get angry. You know, let it out there. Because you're already perceived as a threat. If you lose your temper, who knows? Who knows?
Well, and you've touched on the rules for your family and your concerns about Lewis Patrick. And you have law enforcement, and you've mentioned this too, you have law enforcement officers in your family. And we've talked about what's really happened to increase the fear you have. Even with your background, even with family members who are in law enforcement, you still have that fear. Okay, what I'm saying is that she was saying, we were talking earlier, and she mentioned that she had law enforcement family members. And yet she still has that fear. And so you've mentioned it a little bit, but what do you attribute that to?
It was more just seeing in the media what's going on and wondering if there is going to be justice, and in the back of my mind saying, no, probably not, because historically that's the case. I don't know. It was more fear of the unknown, what's going to happen. And again, I said, okay, I can't go there. I have to work in the present, walking in God's grace, walking forward in faith, not fear. I also had to call my brother and say, talk me through this. Now talk to your nephew, get him through this. And it was more of a, this is not your situation. You know, this is something completely different. But still, I think about Florida. Young man is going home. He went to the store to get his brother candy, and he's walking home. And it wasn't a police officer, but it was somebody who decided to designate himself in authority, who shoots him. And this is for my son. This could be me going to the store to get candy for my sister. That's where the fear came in. And I was like, no, we're just not going to go there. We're not going to approach life this way.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Chief, what effect do the media portrayals of law enforcement have on the general population?
Well, that's a big effect, like I mentioned earlier. You know, the media is going to shape a public opinion about a story, or about whatever situation it may be, whether it's good or bad or right or wrong, or they have the facts, or they trying to get their story out first. You know, what a lot of people see on TV or Facebook or social media or whatever it may be, they believe it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's correct, but because they see it being broadcast, especially on TV or written in the paper, most people take that as the gospel. And most of the time, there's a lot of gaps in there. You know, if you really know the true story, there's a lot of gaps. So that's why it's important to get the correct information out. But in our society, a lot of times the media want to be first. And again, I've experienced this. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's correct what they're putting out, but they want to be the first one to put that information out. And then when people like yourself see it, you know, well, it's on TV, so it's got to be true. So a lot of times that's the case.
Joyce, what do you think about the media portrayals of things, how that affects our society?
I agree. The media is all about sensationalism, what's going to get your attention. That's why I don't watch television news. I listen to NPR to try to get a more round story. There are truths portrayed, but there's a whole lot of truths that are left out. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that, yeah, this happened, but then what's the backstory? That's the part we don't know. That's why I have to do that balancing. The part I hear makes me scared, but wait a minute. What am I not hearing here? Big brother, talk to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're right. I mean, that's the point of today, to be able to try to get an understanding of there's more to situations than we may understand in our soundbite kind of world we live in. Mm-hmm. So what do you think it says about our world, Joyce, that you as an African American have to take such self-preservation or self-protection measures?
This is a conversation my son and daughter and husband and I have had many times, and I think it's pretty sad, to be honest with you. People see sometimes the color of your skin or your different religion or you're not the same as who they are, and it's automatic fear because you're different. Then we have to protect ourselves because, well, heck, I don't know if you have a gun or not or what you're going to do. And I don't think this is the way it should be. When I think of myself, I think, but I was created in God's own image. And if you're created in God's own image and you're created in God's own image, then God sees us as all, not as black, white, Hispanic, Asian, whatever. We are all. And one day I would like to see us all embrace that. But it ain't happening so far. And that's the sad part about it.
Mm-hmm. Chief, any comment, additional comment on that?
Yes, I'll add, when I grew up in, I was born in 1964, so I'm 51 now. My parents taught us always respect authority, whether it's a school teacher, a police officer, a minister, whoever it may be. Now, I can agree with what Joyce mentioned about, we were always told you have to be twice as good to be accepted. That's why my father was a school teacher, 35, 36 years, my father was a teacher. But they always told us, get all the education that you can get. Nobody can take that away from you. But once you start getting in the job market, a lot of times you're going to have to be twice as good because of the color of your skin. So that's what I've always live by, to try to be twice as good, to be equal, so to speak. Now, she also mentioned where someone in the community called law enforcement because of the color of her skin. That happens right here in Winston-Salem. You know, because someone may be different in a neighborhood, somebody pick up the phone, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then you have the police officer responding and asking the person, well, why are you over here? But we're obligated to respond. Anytime someone calls the communication center and there's a call for service, we have to respond. Now, is it right or is it wrong because someone picked up the phone and said there's a black person or a white person in the neighborhood, why are they here? But we're obligated to respond. Also, you have people in this community right now that request the color of a police officer to respond to their house. They say, send a white police officer to my house. Even though they don't get that luxury, you know, we send the first unit that's available. But that's occurring right here in this community. So you see what we're dealing with, so to speak.
Yeah, and it puts you in a bad light too. Someone calls who has a concern, they call, the police respond, and then the person who is under surveillance now thinks that the police are just
profiling
them because of whatever reason. Maybe in that situation, they're just responding to a request of somebody else who you never know who they are. So that's complicated. Well, what do you see, Joyce, as the root causes of some of these issues?
Ignorance. Ignorance. Fear is nothing but ignorance. Can you hear me? Your hands, you're cupped.
Sure. I said, what are some of the root causes that you see in the midst of these situations?
Ignorance. Fear is ignorance. That's the root cause, ignorance. How does that change?
Maybe by ignorant people realizing that they're ignorant. I mean, you don't, if you're in a lot of times you're in a majority perspective, maybe you don't even realize. You don't even realize. I mean, I don't think a lot of us Anglo appreciate fully the layers that you have to deal with, either of you. Chief, how about you? What's the root cause that you see in the midst of this too?
Some of it is probably ignorance, but some of it is just from what people see and what they're being told. And there is some truth to some of it. I mean, if we really want to drill it down, there is some truth. There's some truth where people may be fearful for going on or going in certain parts of the city just by some of the activity that occurs there. Some people are afraid to go to the mall. Some people are afraid to go to the eastern part of the city. Some people are afraid to go to the south side just because of what they see and what they read about in the newspaper. Now, all of those people that live in East Winston or on the south side or the west side, for that example, they're not bad people. Everybody that you see with their pants hanging down and they have the hair braided, they're not thugs. A lot of those people are very intelligent and very educated. I went to college with a guy, he's an attorney now, but if he walked in this room, most people would probably profile him and think that he's a drug dealer just by the way he looks. But he's a very prominent attorney, but that's the way he chooses to dress and wear his clothing. So all those different things come into play with it.
Chief, what are some opportunities for the general public to better appreciate the challenges that you guys face in law enforcement?
I think having events and forums like this, you know, just to listen and understand some of the challenges. Also, you're free to do a ride-along with the police department anytime you choose to do it. Only thing we need to do is do a real quick background check, and you can get out and see some of the things that the officers have to deal with. Some of the calls for service that they go on, some of the situations that they're put in. And also we have a citizen police academy where you'll learn some of the reasons why we do certain things.
Now, I know there's no participation allowed, but I will say, raise your hand if you've ever done a ride-along. So you ride along with an officer, you're paired with an officer, and they do it in a lot of different ways. And I did it through Leadership Winston-Salem, and there's all different kinds of other opportunities, but it really is impactful and meaningful, and it's very easy to set up too. So I would encourage you to consider that. Okay, I'm just touched on the racist behavior that the police department has to deal with in terms of the people that respond. Chief, how difficult is it to be a public servant when you have to serve people who show racist behavior towards you or towards the department?
It can be difficult, but what I try to do is do what's right. That's number one. That's the way I was taught. You have to do what's right, and you have to do what you've been paid to do. A lot of it is ignorance, and really, that's what I tell the police officers. You go out and you do what you're trained to do, number one. Don't abuse anybody. Treat people the way that you would treat your mom or dad, and everything would be okay. But it can beat you down if you allow it to beat you down. But I think that we have a lot of support in Winston-Salem. Support not only from one or two different races. I think overall, you know, we're supported well here in Winston-Salem, whether it's from the black community or white, Hispanic, or whatever race it may be. Now, you'll get a few people to get up in front of a camera, beat their chest, and talk about how bad things are. But overall, across the city in Winston-Salem, I feel that we are supported in Winston-Salem.
In our conversation a couple days ago, you talked about a little bit about how the nature of law enforcement is not, you're not called during the sunny moments. Can you just talk about how the nature of it is just, you're called during certain kinds of things going on?
I think we were talking about how some communities say, well, why are you over here so much? Well, we're not really necessarily in that community more than in other communities, because the way we're deployed, we have equal staffing across the city, whether it's the southern part of the city or the eastern part of the city or the western part of the city. But I think the conversation kind of wind up being that people don't call the police when times are good. You know, there's some kind of crisis, there's something going wrong in that person's life for them to call the police. Someone not pick up the phone and say, come over here, we're having a cookout today, just stop by. You know, there's something going on with a domestic violence, a family dispute, someone's been shot, hurt. So we're called in when there's no other form of government to respond. And a lot of issues that we deal with are not necessarily criminal matters. You know, at 3 o'clock in the morning and you don't have anybody else to call, you know, we're the most visible form of government. You pick up the phone, we're gonna show up at your house and help talk you through the situation, whatever it may be, or either get you the resources so you can deal with the problem that you're dealing with.
Joyce, you touched on it a little bit, but what do you see as the changes that have gone on and since those days in Nebraska? Do you feel like we're in a better place in terms of, and this is more, maybe not so much in just in terms of law enforcement, but just in general in terms of racial discrimination?
Racial discrimination overall, are we in a better place? No, we're not. I'm sorry to say that. No. Am I in a better place here versus Nebraska and law enforcement? Absolutely. I haven't had as many incidences. I mean, the one in August made the hair on the back of my neck raise, but that hasn't happened as frequently as it probably would have happened in Nebraska. So, but in terms of race relationships,
Okay. Chief, how have you seen, or what changes have you seen in the past 30 years in law enforcement?
I guess the biggest thing is law enforcement is not really respected the way it was at one point. And in my personal opinion, I think there are several factors that we deal with. Number one, people just don't have the respect that they had years ago. You know, whether it's for a police officer, whether it's for a teacher, a minister, or whatever it may be. And then we're dealing with a society where life is not valued. I mean, it's not. Whether it's for the movies that we watch or the games that we play on the Xbox or whatever it may be, human life is just not, it doesn't have the value that it had before. You know, any time where you can have a city that has 500 homicides like Chicago, you know, there's no value for human life. Or any time you have to have police officers in school, there's no value for rules or regulations. So I think those are the biggest thing. Anytime you're stopped by a police officer and you want to argue on the side of the road, those are some of the things that never happened years ago that you see frequently now, where you just don't want to conform to the rules. So some of that is lies on the shoulders of not necessarily the police officers, but also just from, as a society, the way we conduct ourselves overall.
How about the role of class as a challenge in our community?
And when you say class, you mean like class and status, the haves and the haves not, so to speak? That comes into play also. I guess that comes into play like when a person in a certain part of the city may call the police officer or may call the police just because they see somebody different in their community. Sometimes that occur in certain parts of the city, like in our downtown area. Even though downtown is for everyone, sometimes we get requests when we have certain people downtown or certain groups downtown to do certain things. But that area is for everyone. So if that's what you mean as far as class, yes, it comes into play sometimes.
How about training that officers receive And what about at the academy, in the academy days? What do you think best prepares them for stressful situations that they might face?
There's a lot of different things. There's, you know, we far exceed the state standard as far as our basic law enforcement training academy. But we put the officers through very stressful situations dealing with, first of all, our academy instructors. And then once they are, once they graduate from the basic law enforcement academy, of course, they are paired with a seasoned police officer. And then they get the experience of riding in different parts of the city, dealing with different type calls and different individuals.
And how about just for officers as far as continuing training and that kind of thing? How is that built into their professional life?
That's built in with different types of training, like I mentioned before about diversity training. We have training for mental illness. We have just ongoing training to help deal with all the situations that we're seeing across the country now.
All right, Joyce, do you have any sort of, we're time to kind of give some last words. Do you have any comments of things that we didn't cover that you wanted to say to this group, just to share your perspective?
I think you pretty much heard it. I can't think of anything else to add. Touching back on your last question, whether things have changed, and I say, no, not really. I still stand by that. I see things maybe rolling backwards, and I think we kind of discussed that on Monday. Things are going backwards instead of progressing forward. How do you change that? And I guess it's one man at a time. One man at a time. And so I try to step out, and I try to get my family to step out, really to embrace and get to know people and get people to know us. You don't have to embrace us, but at least, I don't know, moving past the ignorance and past the fear and realizing beyond the skin color, we have the same desires. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of seeing me as your black friend, see me as your friend.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Every African American is the same, or any group is all the same. It's just a fallacy. I said the idea that any group of any folk are all the same, that you feel like you know something about them just because of some outward symbol, is just a fallacy. That's for sure.
That's correct. What's going on nationally across the country about yeah. police officers. You know, regardless of what you see on TV, all police officers aren't that way. But we get painted with that broad brush. Mm-hmm. You know, something can happen in Los Angeles, California, where all police officers are the same. And that's not a fair assumption.
Chief, do you have any comment, any kind of closing comment that we didn't cover?
No, I think we covered most things. I guess going back to what's different, now you're seeing police officers being targeted, but that's not broadcast widely across the TV either. You know, New York just had 4 police officers killed in less than 11 months. We've had, my tenure in Winston-Salem, 8 police officers have lost their lives. And about 5 of them been from gunfire. So it's not like a police officer is just out there running rampant and not in any danger. You know, if you really look at the statistics and look at the amount of guns, and we're outmatched or outgunned any day of the week just by the guns that are out here on the street now.
It's true. And we just want to thank you, Chief, for your commitment to our community and to your professionalism and for your willingness to be here. And let's give them a show of appreciation for that. And we'll say personally to Joyce, we really appreciate you being here, and you're a part of things here at St. Paul's, but this is a very much of a step in faith, really, and we appreciate that. So we're grateful to you. So let's give her a hand, too. All right, now I'll pass it over to Dixon to close us.
Thanks. Thank you both so much. I'm going to close this with a word of prayer. Just a couple of announcements on behalf of the committee. The first is that our first opportunity to have some intentional dialogue and processing around this conversation will be January 21st through the 22nd. The Trinity Institute is hosting an event called Listen for Change, and it's being simulcast across the United States from Trinity Wall Street. We are going to be a host and partner site, and so that'll be here in this room. We'll have the simulcast going on the screen, and then there'll be breakout discussions. And this is some of what they're saying about it. Tell me if this sounds familiar. This conversation is presented as a learning opportunity, a chance to engage in deep listening and truth-telling, and as a result, develop the skills to create change within a troubled system. Sounds like we're all onto something with this. So it's going to be a great opportunity where they're going to address sort of systemic sin that goes into racism and racial discrimination and all the kind of nuances I think that many of us want to dig into. So that'll be on January 21st through the 22nd. There'll be more information coming, and I think next month we'll probably have like a flyer or something to give out. You might even have it today. Okay, so Jocelyn has a couple. So the other part of that is to say our next meeting with Faith and Justice Committee is on November the 19th, right here. Testimonies will be from Louis Patrick Moi, Joyce's son, and the Reverend Lawrence Womack, who's standing back there. They will be sharing some of their stories from their perspective. And then they're taking December off, correct, Jocelyn? Great. If you want to stick around 15, 20 minutes or so to process a little bit, think about the things that you've learned, want to invite you to do so. And some of the committee members might drop in on your conversation to hear what you're saying. And Linda has one more thing for me to say. Yeah. Our presiding bishop, soon to be, Bishop Michael Curry, he's one of the speakers. There are many. This event's really cool, y'all. It's something that I wish we could all go to. The fact that we can simulcast it will be well worth our time. I think it'll be great to hear Bishop Curry talk about this directly. So with that said, I'm going to close this with a word of prayer. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. God, we hear these stories today and cannot help but be changed because we've heard the perspective of another. And the places that our hearts and eyes and minds have been opened to a broader truth, to a reality of injustice, to the complications of things that we thought were simple. We ask that you would move in that space to make us a people that are more open, more loving, more hospitable toward you and toward our neighbor, that we could be part of the change that we want to see in this world, and that the prayers that we pray about race and racial injustice and the difficulties and the tensions and all that we've discussed, that we could find the places that we are being called to be the answer to that prayer. We trust that our listening here today will be a listening that does inspire us to act as your listening inspires you to act, and that when we act, we would do so in truth and beauty and love. We pray these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. Thank you, everyone.